This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At the beginning of this month, we did a show on sex abuse by educators that focused on the prevalence of sex abuse in schools and what's being done about it, or not, by both school administrators and state legislatures. The response was overwhelming, so we've decided to do a follow-up. Today, we focus on the emotional impact on students, warning signs, and how some educators use cell phones and computers to seduce children. If you've dealt with this issue in a personal way, we want to hear from you. As you look back, were there warning signs? What kind of impact did the abuse have on you? How did you cope? And did texting or websites like MySpace and Facebook play a part? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join our conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Jenna Bramo. She's now 20 years old, a single mom, and a waitress in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. She was molested when she was 7 years old in second grade. She joins us on the phone from her mother's house. And thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Hello, Jenna.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you tell us what happened back when you were in second grade?
Well, it happened a while ago. We would all be in music class, and it started off one day, and I don't really remember how it started. I was getting up to get a drink, and my teacher had pulled me towards him, and he tried to make me touch him in a really inappropriate way. And he had done it a few other times after that. And then we had got a hold of the, we had told the principal, we had made a complaint, me and a couple other girls, and we got our parents involved, and they didn't want to do anything about it, so we tried to take it further because he was touching us, and he had touched a lot of other students, too, in the past, and we just wanted to get something done about it.
And as I understand it, he was never charged with anything.
Nope, never charged.
You took him to court, though. You sued him.
Yeah, we did sue him. And it happened about 2.5 years ago. It finally happened 2.5 years ago.
And after all that time, he was still teaching?
Yep. Well, hey, listen to this. All right, we had ended up we got a hold of Tom Riley, a lawyer that's here in Cedar Rapids, and he tried his best to get something done about it. And we had went on to a further source. We went to Roxanne Conlin, and that's the one that finally got to sue him. But they said it was in his best interest if he resigned from Van Buren or retired. And he had went on to, I think he was a janitor out in Vinton. He was out there, and he was in another school, so he just left Van Buren, but he did go a different school. So he did leave there, but he kept teaching, and
kept
I don't really know what he did after that.
In contact with young children.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Why, after all that time, did you feel it was necessary to pursue him?
Because he would probably keep doing it to other students, other children. I just wanted to get his license taken away, and finally it did get taken away.
And
we wanted something to be done about it, because it's not right.
No, of course it's not right. What's been the effect of that incident on your life?
Well, I didn't want to be around any older men. I remember that. Like, I had seen a guy that looked really similar to him, and I just lashed out. Like, I blacked out, and they found me in the corner, like, shaking at school, and it just turned out to be one of my friend's dads. And I just didn't want to listen to any authority. And then I got over it because I have a kid now, and I got to put that in the past. But, like, I'll tell anybody about it, you know? I mean,
in a way,
I'm not the only one that's ever happened to, and there's people out there that won't say nothing.
Yeah.
They won't say anything.
And in a way, I suspect you never get over it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you won't ever get over it, but you kind of got to move on because now his license is taken away, so hopefully he won't do it to anybody else ever again, and I'm finally at peace with it.
Did you end up suing him or the school district?
The school district. And I believe we did sue him, too, but we sued the school district for negligence because they knew about it. Because they, first it started out in Owine in the 60s, we found out, and there was this principal. He let him go because he had touched a child, and he didn't really want to do anything about it too much because he had a child at home himself, Mr. Lindsay did. And he like, slapped him on the wrist. He told him that he couldn't work there no more. And he trusted that he wouldn't do it again. And he had somehow went to Illinois, if he was teaching or whatever. He did it to 150 students, we found out, and 50 at Van Buren alone when he came back to Cedar Rapids. And we were just really shocked, really, really shocked about it.
Did anyone, the principal or anybody from the school district, ever say they were sorry?
No. Nope. That's the thing about it. I mean, I don't get it. We do not understand why nothing ever happened. Nothing. Because I know Iowa is one of the places in the United States, one of the states that there is not a mandatory background check. But Roxanne Collin, the lawyer that we had, she had got it approved for everybody to get a background check if they're involved with children before we even got a hold of her. And so we finally did get a hold of her, and she found out all this information. We never knew to what extent it was until we got a hold of her.
Now, you confronted this teacher in court.
What now?
The teacher was there in court during the case, correct?
Yeah, I didn't see him. He kept saying that he didn't recall anything, any of it.
So he just denied it all?
Yeah, pretty much. But they knew. He's guilty. I'm really upset about it.
I can understand. And your kid is how old now?
My baby's 6 months. He'll be 6 months, December 6th.
So, what, 4 or 5 years, he or she's going to be going off to kindergarten?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to worry about that?
I'm worried, but not so much as I would have been before if nothing would have been done about this, because now they know that they're out there. And it's close to home. I mean, it happened to me, and it can happen to anybody's child if we don't look out. I understand now how my parents felt, because I would freak out. I would literally freak out if anything ever happened to my baby.
Jenna Bramo, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Jenna Bramo joined us by phone from her mother's house in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And with us now is Robert Shoup. He's the author of the book Sexual Exploitation in Schools, How to Spot It and Stop It. He's also director of Kansas State University's Cargill Center for Ethical Leadership and joins us from the studios of Kansas State Radio Network in Manhattan, Kansas. And it's good to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
And as you were listening to Jenna's story, regrettably, it doesn't sound all that unusual, does it?
No, unfortunately, her story is a very good example of how most of us can't imagine this could happen, and we're looking the wrong way. And if you're not looking the right way, you may not see it. And many parents in many schools, even to this day, think this is a very unusual and very rare situation, but there are thousands of children being harmed every day by teachers and coaches and school systems.
Mm-hmm. I know you've interviewed a number of abusers. You've served as a forensic expert witness in dozens of court cases addressing sexual harassment, but you've broken them down into two different types.
Well, there's two modalities of abuse that generally are found in a school system. One is the predator who basically, I interviewed a person in prison who said, I went into teaching because that's where the children are. I'm clean cut, I don't drink, I don't smoke. What parent wouldn't want me to spend time with their children? And in some cases, these people have dozens, 20, 30, 40, 50, and as Jenna said in her case, hundreds of children can be molested by this same person. That person is a person who goes into to find children, and they're very good at finding them, and they're very secretive and very difficult to detect. The other modality happens, and the damage is done is just as great from both types. But the second type typically only has one victim, and this person really is a person who is a molester of opportunity. They have a very poor concept of ethics. They have very poor understanding of appropriate boundaries, and they slip across from being a mentor to being a molester. And these people actually, in many cases, think they're in love with the child, even though the child may be 10, 11, or 12 years old.
And the effect of their they act pretty much the same, though.
If you would look at the behavior with the child, they're almost identical. And as Jenna said, there's threshold behaviors that they oftentimes start with very innocuous behaviors. And if the child rebuffs them or they're noticed at that time, they'll go away from that child and find someone else. But the behaviors start innocuously and become more and more intrusive until there's actually intercourse taking place.
And as this goes on, there are warning signs that parents and responsible teachers, and again, the vast majority of American teachers are perfectly responsible adults worthy of our trust. But there are warning signs that parents and responsible teachers should be able to look for.
Well, yes, they are, Neil. And in fact, what you just said is very ironic, because the fact that the vast majority of teachers are competent, capable, caring people makes it difficult for us to believe that any teacher could harm our child. And because of that, we see signs, but there's a cognitive dissonance, and we just say, well, this is a little odd, but I'm sure he wouldn't do anything because he's such a great teacher. And some of these signs, for example, taken individually may be appropriate. For example, a teacher shouldn't be buying gifts for children. buying a pencil for all the children is one thing, but many of these people buy iPods or tennis shoes or take them to amusement parks or whatever. There's just no reason for a teacher doing this. You mentioned in your foreword about the fact that now social networking and technology makes it very easy for these people to get access to children with instant messaging. I've had cases where the teacher is sending 20 or 30 messages a night to a child at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. or 4 a.m.
So they can be in touch with this, with their victim, 24 hours a day.
Absolutely. And it's very difficult for a parent to know that that's taking place.
Texting doesn't ring like a phone rings, and a lot of kids have their own cell phones, so it's not as if, I guess in the old days, the predator would have to call the house and hang up if a grown-up answered.
Absolutely. Technology has wonderful, positive educational applications, but it also has some very serious downsides.
And what about sites like MySpace and Facebook? A lot of teachers will have those pages on those sites to begin with.
Well, that's very true. The younger teachers coming to the profession now are very different in their attitude toward privacy and communication, where a person in their 40s or 50s may not talk about certain things to everybody they know. Now an 18 or a 19-year-old will talk about everything to everybody. So the idea of breaking down barriers and civility and common courtesies makes it easier for a person to cross into that conversation about their sexual activities and their sexual interests, and they don't quite understand the dangers of that kind of communication.
Because a lot of kids are flattered. They're also titillated.
Well, that's the factor. I think of the parents that are listening to your show this afternoon. You know, think of a child that's 12 or 13 years old, and the most popular, most competent, maybe the most attractive teacher in school comes up to that child and says, "You're so interesting and you're so bright and you're so mature for your age. When I talk to you, it's just like talking to an adult." What child wouldn't be flattered by that?
We're talking about the problem of sex abuse by teachers and educators, what to watch out for, how to keep your kids safe. More with Robert Shoup, author of Sexual Exploitations in Schools, How to Spot It and How to Stop It, in a moment. And your stories, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As we've said before, there are several million educators in the United States. The vast majority of them more than deserve our respect and trust. Our focus today is on the few who abuse their positions and their students. We're talking about the effects of sexual abuse on students, signs to watch out for, and the role of technology in enabling abusers and gathering evidence against them. You can read more about that in the latest edition of Education Week at edweek.org. Our guest is Robert Shoup. He's the author of the book Sexual Exploitation in Schools, How to Spot It and Stop It, and he's director of the Kansas State University's Cargill Center for Ethical Leadership. If you've dealt with this issue in a personal way, we want to hear from you. As you look back, were there warning signs? What kind of impact did the abuse have on you? And our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Justin. Justin with us from Watsonville in California.
Good day.
Hey.
Hi. I just have a brief cautionary tale for your listeners. Can you hear me?
Sir, go ahead, please.
When I was elementary school age, I was sexually abused by both a teacher and a Cub Scout leader at about the same time. And I felt that one reason that this was happening to me was that both of the teacher and the Cub Scout leader were aware that I'd been cut loose by my parents, somewhat set adrift, and that because my parents were not anywhere to be seen, it basically put a target on my back or made me a lower risk opportunity or a low-risk target. And I just think it's important for your listeners to know that it's really important to be involved in your kids' education, to know your kids' teachers, and to be spending time with your kids, know where they are after school, know who's taking them on school field trips. It's devastating, the long-term effect that this can have on people, and there's a lot more of it going on than people realize.
What was the effect on you, Justin?
Well, for me personally, because my parents weren't particularly present in my education and my upbringing, I was very afraid of not being believed that this was happening. So eventually I went to my older brother And he also was afraid that we wouldn't be believed. So he approached this teacher directly and threatened to blow the whistle on him. I don't believe that this teacher was ever caught or any legal action was taken. But when I became about 12 or 13, I very quickly got into substance abuse, looked for ways of numbing myself out and trying to damp down the feelings that this had left me with. And, you know, I eventually managed to get out of that problem. But this stayed stuffed down in me until I was in my mid-20s and a parent myself. I was having difficulties in my marriage and I went for therapy. And this all came to the surface, and I really had not realized how big an issue and how many problems this had been creating in my life. And I feel that I've managed to move on, you know, quite successfully now. But, you know, you can't belittle the size of the problem and how deeply devastating this can be.
Justin, thanks very much for calling to share that.
That's a pleasure.
Appreciate Bye-bye. It. Bye-bye. And Robert Shoup, one of the things that he was talking about was the feeling that he had a target on his back. Some of these predators you're talking about are experts at picking out those children.
Well, Neil, I think what Justin raised is a very important point, but it has two parts to it. On the one hand, children who are vulnerable are vulnerable targets. And if the child does have a very low self-concept, if they're not being attended to, they may be seen as an easy target. But I've also dealt with cases where both parents are very effective, very caring parents. They're people who are professional people who go to school. And I think it's a danger to think that the only child who can be the prey of these people are the child who is not cared for in the most appropriate manner. The victim can be from the president of the community college's child to someone who's a director in a Fortune 500 company.
So it's anybody.
Anybody can be vulnerable if they're not given the tools to protect themselves, if parents aren't paying attention, and if schools haven't taken appropriate action to protect their children.
And both the stories that we heard today, Justin's story that we just heard, and Jenna's earlier, she got no, the perpetrator was not caught, not criminally charged. Nothing happened until many years afterwards in Jenna's case.
Well, and that's still happening in 2007. I think there's certainly more awareness, and NPR's focus on this is a very important activity. But there still is a denial stage. And I think the other thing that people have to understand is when you send your child to school and say, mind the teacher and do what the teacher tells you, without telling them that everything isn't appropriate, or you talk about stranger danger, you're telling people the only people who can harm you are people you don't know. The fact is the vast majority of children who are molested by people who someone lets inside the family.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Adam. Adam calling us from Auburn in New York.
Yes. When I was in high school, my girlfriend's friend was 18 and was carrying on a sexual relationship with one of the teachers. And I've later found out that this is something that he did with many other females, and all of which who were of consenting age, probably not by coincidence. Now, is there anything, any laws or anything in place to prevent that? I mean, everything was done outside of the school. He was obviously trying to cover his back, but still very inappropriate behavior.
Robert Shoup, can you help Adam out?
Yes, Adam's point is really right on the cutting edge of what's happening in the law today. There was a time when each state has its own age of consent, and there are teachers who would groom the child for months until the child reached that age of 15, 16, 17, or 18, and then have sex with them, knowing that even if they were caught, they couldn't be prosecuted. But now many states are actually passing specific legislation that says if the sexual relationship is between a teacher and a student, the age of the student is irrelevant, even if they're up to 18 years old. So now if a child in these states has sexual relationship, even if they're above the age of legal consent, it's still a criminal event because the special power relationship that teacher and that student have. And that's starting in more and more states, but it's still only a small minority of the states. Many states have not addressed that yet.
Oh, great. That's good to know. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Adam. And here's an email we have from James in Edgerton, Ohio. The situation has raised its ugly head in our small-town public school system, but parents are reluctant to butt heads with the administration here due to apathy or stonewalling the charges. What are the best ways to deal with these issues in the school system, especially if the complaint is diminished at the administration level, i.e. principal, superintendent, or school board?
Well, there's two ways of responding to that. The first is you should be involved before there is a complaint. while the school is not under any kind of attack or supervision, you should make sure that there's a very clear policy prohibiting any romantic or sexual relationship between adults and children. There should be clear policy. All the teachers should be trained on what's appropriate and inappropriate, and all the students should be trained about what's appropriate and inappropriate, and the parents should be involved. If, in fact, an allegation comes and there hasn't been any training or there hasn't been any policy, then what you need to do is clearly let the school know that this is illegal. It's not just inappropriate. And people use terms like the child had a romantic relationship or the child had an affair. The child's been raped by this adult. And I think we have to very clearly say that an adult having sexual relationship with the children is rape. It's not an affair. It's not flirting. It's not having some kind of an inappropriate relationship. We have to talk about it as dramatically as it truly is.
And the other, in Adam's phone call, you were saying in terms of the law, aren't school systems liable if they're aware of complaints and do nothing about them?
Well, there's three or four levels of liability. One is every state has what's called a mandatory Child Abuse Reporting Act. And that says that if any school has a reason to suspect that a child is being sexually abused, they have a legal duty to report it to their state, and that state will conduct the investigation. So the school doesn't even have to prove it happened. Just any teacher, paraprofessional, psychologist, or counselor who thinks something is odd here, something may be inappropriate here, I'll get a professional in here to investigate. The second level is each state has a certification office that controls the certification of teachers, and any complaint should be brought to them, and they will investigate, and hopefully if in fact the facts show that it was abuse, will remove the child, the teacher's teaching certificate. The other level is just a straight negligence. Schools have an affirmative duty to have a safe and orderly learning environment, and every child has the right to come to school free of fear and intimidation and harassment. And if your child is being harassed or abused in the school, that school is liable for negligence, and the harm that that child has done to them is the responsibility of the agency that allowed it to happen.
Let's get Jane on the line. Jane's calling us from Michigan.
Hi. I wanted to know, my son was 16, going on 17, and we moved into a condominium. I was in the process of divorce, and there was a teacher that was living upstairs, and she kept wanting to do things with him, taking him to her job and things of that sort. And I kept saying no. And my son's like, "Yep, Mom, why is she doing that?" I said, you know, and then all these red flags came out. And what do you do against that? I mean, my son had, I went to work and he was at home by himself, and she would want to, you know, talk to him and that. And so she left the condominium, but still, you know, I thought to myself, if she did this to my son, she's probably doing it to somebody in her class or something.
Did you get in contact with the school at all?
Well, it wasn't a school teacher. I mean, she was a school teacher, but not at my school.
I see.
At my son's school. So I just thought, what do you do in that case?
Mm-hmm. Any ideas, Robert Chu?
Jane, when you became aware of this, did you tell your child not to be alone with that teacher?
Well, you know, we're still in the same condominium. They had to
right.
cross, you know, sometime. And I would say, well, don't open the door to her and just ignore her. And then she got really belligerent, because we wouldn't talk to her anymore. So.
Well, I think the fact that you were told by your son is a great testimony to the fact that your child felt comfortable to talk to you. And I think that's one of the things that parents have to do. Many parents who hear about these stories think about this as happening to 14, 15, 16 years old. But as Jenna, the first person that was interviewed, said, I've worked in cases where children as young as 5 and 6 years old are sexually abused by teachers in the school. So parents need to talk to the child very early and help them be preventative and let them talk to you. And then once you have the information, I think you have a duty not just to protect your child, but to help protect other children by calling the agency that this person works for and just say, here's what's happening, you need to look into this.
Okay, thank you very much. But when I did tell his father, it was like, haha, that's funny. You know, they look at it differently if it's a woman.
Jane, that's another issue that we haven't addressed yet, and that is society very clearly has a double standard in terms of how they perceive abuse of children. In the recent cases of Letourneau and Lefebvre and so on, where you have a fairly young, stereotypically attractive female who has sex with a 13 or 14-year-old boy, that becomes fodder for late night talk show hosts to make jokes about it and say, who wouldn't want to have sex with her? But very seldom would you hear that person have the same story if it was a 35-year-old man and a 13-year-old girl. Even the court system still addresses it differently, where typically a male would get 15 to 20 years or more for raping a child in a school setting. In many cases, a female who rapes a male child will get probation or 2 or 3 years or a suspended sentence. And I think we as citizens and parents have to let them know the court system that this is just not tolerable. A child is a child, and they need to be protected.
And rape is rape. Jane, thanks very much for the call, and good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. We're talking about sex abuse by educators. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's bring another voice into the conversation. Cheryl Shakeshaft, professor and chairperson of the Department of Educational Leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University, author of a congressionally mandated study on educator sexual misconduct, and has served as an expert witness in a number of legal proceedings on this issue. She joined us from the studios at WVCU in Richmond, Virginia. You may remember her from our earlier broadcast on this subject. Nice to have you back on the program today.
Nice to be back.
And I wanted to ask you a question we got in an email from Liz in Beasley's Point in New Jersey. Can you discuss the percentage of male teachers involved and the percentage of female teachers involved? Also, where does the National Education Association stand on this issue?
I can't tell you the percent of male and female teachers involved because we have no studies that actually look at it from the number of teachers or the proportion of teachers. The studies we have, and there are very few studies, really look at it from the victim's perspective. So the studies are studies of people who have been targeted or of people in general and who report whether or not they have been a victim of sexual misconduct or sexual abuse of a teacher or someone else.
Mm-hmm.
We think that it's probably about 1 to 2% of teachers, but really, we don't know.
We don't know. Also, the NEA, where does it stand?
Don't know where the NEA stands. By and large, the NEA has come out each time this comes up and says we're opposed to teachers sexually abusing kids, but we want to remind you that most teachers don't abuse. We aren't seeing any internal work with the NEA trying to develop materials or programs to make sure that nothing happens. And what we do tend to hear from the NEA and others is the complaint that we're casting all teachers as bad by bringing up this issue. This is a really important piece. We, even in this show, we've had to say things like, most teachers don't sexually abuse. Most teachers don't do this. It's very few. You know, that really isn't necessary to say. That's true about pretty much any crime. It's true about parents. It's true about bankers who kill people. It's true about everybody. And the fact that we feel we have to tread so lightly as to not offend people in the teaching profession, it all contributes to kids and adults feeling like they can't bring it up.
Here's another email. This is from Terry in DeKalb, Illinois. My abuser, a friend's father, groomed me over a period of years so that I would, one, believe it was consensual, and two, know what the right answers were to questions. He billed himself as my mentor and protector, gaining my parents' trust, was even my legal guardian for a little while. Please stress the grooming and manipulation that causes many victims to defend their abusers. It was too cruel a reality for me to face for many years.
This is a typical story, not meaning it's typical that it's we should discount it, but people who sexually abuse kids groom them. They work hard to make sure the child begins to trust them, as Bob Shoup said. They have threshold behaviors. They also work hard to groom the rest of the community. It's important for parents to think that this person is a safe person. It's important for the rest of the community in the school to think that this person is a safe person. So the abuser grooms the child, and the abuser also grooms the parents and grooms the community. And what happens is that you bring the child in to the mix slowly, and at every level you reinforce to the child that it's their fault. At every level, what the grooming does is say, if you would have only just stopped it, this wouldn't have happened, so this is your fault. And that's exactly how kids feel. They feel as if this is my fault. I should have done this. I should have done that. And that's one of the points of the grooming process, is to make sure that the target or the victim of the sexual abuse takes on the responsibility for it having happened.
That is Cheryl Shakeshaft of Virginia Commonwealth University. Robert Shoup is also with us. He's the author of Sexual Exploitation in Schools, How to Spot It and Stop It. Give us a call. Is this your story? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. More of your calls and stories when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Back to our main focus this hour, the problem of sexual abuse by educators. Our guests are Robert Shoup, author of Sexual Exploitation in Schools, How to Spot It and Stop It. Also with us is Cheryl Shakeshaft, professor and chairperson of the Department of Educational Leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University. She works with school districts to develop policies and practices to prevent sexual harassment. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And why don't we go to Christina. Christina is with us from Texas.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. Right now I'm engaged in a discussion with my daughter's school. It's a private school, and what they are requiring now, are requesting of parents actually, is for them, not just parents volunteering and chaperoning to go on trips, but asking the parents to submit to a background check. And I have been a substitute teacher in the past, have had undergone fingerprinting, background checks, and I fully support that. I think it's necessary. I have no qualms with that. But when it becomes a generalized, okay, everyone's going to go through the system because we're afraid that somebody's going to abuse somebody's kid, and requesting, you know, and costing the school, the private school where I'm paying tuition, and the tuition costs are going up because of these excessive waste of money for each child. And I'm not talking just parents. I'm talking they're requesting grandparents, anybody who wants to visit the school.
Mm.
And so I think it's excessive. And right now I'm trying to get the school to open up and have a conversation about this and try to discuss it in the open with all the parents.
Cheryl Shakeshaft, is this a wise policy, do you think?
Well, the fingerprinting will rarely pick up the majority of the people who will sexually target kids in schools. It only picks up people who've been involved in the criminal justice system, so who have been prosecuted and usually convicted. So for any school district to feel that background checks or fingerprinting is going to solve the problem, it is false. The money might be better spent in doing a lot of education for kids, for parents, for volunteers, and having volunteers go through some kind of training or awareness program. It will be more likely that you would stop sexual misconduct or sexual abuse of kids if you educate than if you do background checks.
Might the school be trying to protect itself from lawsuits?
Probably is trying to protect itself from lawsuits, but it really won't make a lot of difference. People sue. Background checks haven't been shown to be a good defense against allowing people to sexually abuse kids.
Okay.
And this school that my child goes to is not requiring fingerprinting from the parents, but they are requiring a criminal, you know, a background check. And you know, and to me, it's an infringement on a person's constitutional rights. I mean, in fact, I had to go and get a visitor's badge, put it around my neck, in order to just attend a school function where my daughter was reading her report in class. Now, that to me was ridiculous. I mean, not getting the visitor's badge, mind you, that's okay. I don't mind submitting to that. But and I even had a comment from one of the teachers. Well, aren't you a parent? And I'm like, yeah, I am. I said, it's kind of funny, isn't it? I'm being treated like a criminal. You know, that's how I felt I was being treated. And I do feel like I'm being treated like a criminal. It's almost like they're trying to protect the child from their own parents. Which, yes, that does happen, as you know, and that's. That's a real deal there. There are people out there abusing their children.
Indeed, but you know? Generally not going to school to do it.
Exactly. And
okay, Christina.
It's just ridiculous.
Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So long. Let's turn now to, this is going to be Amber. Amber with us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. When I was in my junior, senior year of high school, there was a very young, hip, attractive teacher who was very interested in one of my friends. Granted, she was very mature, very smart, taking all college classes, but he was an assistant coach on the golf team, and he would invite, you know, a lot of the students over to his house, and we would just fight about where we were going to our friend's house, and we would get his house, and he would give us beer, and we would hang out and spend the night there, and there was no question in my mind that the two of them were having a sexual relationship when we were in high school. And at the time, he was very, very cool. He was the coolest teacher you could ever imagine to have. In retrospect, how inappropriate was that relationship?
And where were your parents allowing you to stay over at his house?
We would just lie. We would say, oh, well, I'm staying at Tracy's, and Tracy's staying at my house. And then at the last minute, we would tell, you know, whoever's parents we were at, oh, well, we decided we're going to stay at the other's house, and, you know, their brother's going to come pick us up. And he would come pick us up from wherever we were. We would walk down the street, and he would come pick us up and let us go. And, you know, we were just very good liars, I guess, to our parents.
Mm-hmm.
But in retrospect, they're still dating. I'm 25, and so is she at this point. And they're still together, and he's still teaching. But they're now in a serious, committed relationship. Very strange. I just wanted to make the point that when you're 17 and a cool, young, hip teacher, you know, you just think he's the coolest thing ever. He could definitely be a creep, but when you're that age, you were completely blinded to the fact, and, you know, most people wouldn't tell their parents if they were in that situation.
Robert Shoup, the coolest, hippest teacher, that's a warning sign, isn't it?
Well, Neil, I think what Amber brings out is a critical issue in terms of training. Many schools have no training. You should train the administrators, you should train every adult who's in the school, you should train the teachers, but you should also train the students to know what the signs are and to not only watch out for themselves, but watch out for their friends. Every case that I've been involved with, after it gets into court, when you take depositions, you'll have a teacher or another student saying, well, I knew something was weird going on, but I just couldn't believe it was what it looked like. Or a teacher will say, well, I saw behavior that just didn't seem right, but after all, he's been here 20 years and he's won 3 teaching awards. I couldn't have believed he did anything like this. And Dr. Shakeshaft's research has shown that in many cases, schools just ignore signs until it's impossible to ignore. It takes a very brave child to come forward and announce that this is happening to them or this is happening to a friend. And I think that's why we have to educate these children. Communication with parents. For many parents, the child comes home from the school and the parent says, how was school today? And the kid says, fine. And the parent says, great. Well, that's not the kind of communication that's going to elicit the information that we need to protect our children.
Thanks very much for the call, Amber. And I'm glad things worked out okay, I guess, for your friend.
Yeah, I mean, if you could say so. But thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Here's an email we got from Jocelyn in Bend, Oregon. Thanks for doing the story on the subject. I was raped by a teacher in 5th grade. The impact of abuse by a trusted adult never leaves you. Finding a healthy sex life due to this event in my life was a long uphill battle. Parents can never underestimate the value of asking children about school and communicating that just because something is done by an adult. My parents knew something had changed with me, but never pressed or investigated what happened. I encourage all parents who notice a drastic change in their child to keep asking questions. And again, thanks for taking on this issue. Keep asking questions, Cheryl Shakeshaft. That's an important element.
Absolutely. And the comment about it never leaves you, it's true. You may learn to deal with it. You may learn to figure out how to make your life work in a way. But there's always there will always be an effect. The studies have shown that sexual abuse of kids by trusted others is related to long-term health issues, to depression, to heart disease, to cancer, to diabetes, related to obesity. And so there's all kinds of issues that are health issues, that are mental health issues, or substance abuse issues. And really, the more we can help kids and parents understand what they should and shouldn't expect from schools, the better we are going to be able to protect them.
And let's go to Jack. And Jack's calling us from Tennessee.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Jack.
Well, this is really strange. I feel like I'm going to be in a therapy session. I'm my late 50s. And when I was in the 3rd grade, a teacher took several of us on a camping trip, And I've never told anybody this, ever. My family, that's why they weren't more specific with my name. It's a little difficult for me. But the male teacher, while we were supposed to be asleep, abused me. And then a friend of mine lying next to me, and I was, and I really hadn't thought about it for years and years until just the last year. It's like it didn't even happen. I felt so ashamed because I felt like on some level I should have, since I was, I guess I pretended to be asleep, but I didn't know what to do. And the next Monday in class, you know, the teacher, you know, had me sit on his lap and wanted to know what was wrong and asked me if I'd had a bad dream, actually. And as I sat waiting to talk to you, it all so comes together. I ended up having to change schools because I started, I stole some things, and I had other sorts of behaviors that my mom ended up changing me to another school. What makes this even more bizarre is I'm a psychiatrist.
Really?
Yes.
And this didn't come out when you did analysis?
Well, I'm not an analyst, so I didn't have to do it with my own analysis, thank God. But I'm a board-certified psychiatrist, and I've certainly done counseling with, especially in training. I'm a geriatric psychiatrist now, but in training, I certainly did a lot of work or some work with kids that had been abused and things, and it never crossed my mind.
And
this had happened to me.
You know better than most people. These things never go away. Like bad pennies, they're going to come back.
Well, it's like it didn't exist until, for some reason, over the last 6 months or so. I got ill a few years ago, and I have a terminal illness that doesn't seem to be as terminal as we thought. I keep seeming to live, and maybe that is what's triggered it. But and I guess I called to feel like I got a chance to tell somebody sort of anonymously what happened. I have tremendous shame telling you this right now. And even with the knowledge I have, I still have these feelings. They're very intense right now of shame.
And you know that this
that
is...
that I did something wrong.
But you know this wasn't your fault. You didn't do anything wrong.
I know. I still have those feelings. Intellectually, I know those things. But on another level, I still feel the shame.
I understand.
You know, Neil, one thing on that is that's another way that these predators control these children. They build that shame. They say, if you ever tell anybody, everybody's going to know that you're a horrible person or you're a slut or you had sex or your mom and dad won't love you anymore or your mom and dad will give you away. And that shame that Jack is feeling now, can you imagine that in the mind of a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy or girl?
In retrospect, Jack, do you think that you stole that stuff so that you would have to change schools and get away from this guy?
Well, you know, now that I'm so brilliant about everybody else but myself, you know, when kids act out, usually they don't know why they're acting out, really. They just begin to do it. And in retrospect, I'm sure that's what caused the behavior because, I mean, how on earth would I have told somebody? I mean, what would I have said? And especially if I knew he did it, wasn't I an accomplice in some way? You know, and wasn't, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Carol?
Shame is the key here. The one of the reasons why there's long-lasting effects for most people in an incident of trusted other to child sexual abuse is because what it induces in people is shame. The difference between shame and guilt is that in guilt, you feel like you made a mistake, you can apologize, you can do better next time. Shame is all about how you feel that you are wrong. That you are the one who's wrong. There's something wrong and bad about you. And sexual abuse of children, what that brings out is shame. And so you have to deal with the shame issue in order to be able, for most people, to be able to heal thoroughly.
Jack, thank you so much for the call. And you may want to talk to somebody else about this now.
Oh, thanks for listening. I'm not going to get a bill.
Yes, absolutely. Just send it to your public radio station, okay?
Okay, all right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we get one final call in. This is Mary. Mary's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi.
Hi, Mary.
I just want to say, first off, just thank you very much for bringing this really difficult issue to many people's consciousness. I think that's what most of all changes all of us and how we behave. It certainly has changed how I give information to my 13-year-old son.
And what happened to you, Mary?
I was in a prep school in New England, and I was suicidal, and I went to a teacher for help, and he listened to my problems and invited me to his dorm room apartment. And I became fixated on him, and one day he kissed me, and I thought I was having an affair with him until about 3 years into sobriety. I had tried to kill myself. I actually ended up trying to be a prostitute, even though I was pretty bad at that. I did a lot of stuff, and I ended up with this one therapist who said that was not an affair, and through work with her, I confronted the school and wrote the board of directors, and they wrote back and said, we're really sorry this happened to you. We'll take care of it from here. And I was very unsatisfied with that. And later on, I had an email confrontation with this teacher, and he said it was my fault and that I'd stalked him on campus while I was a student in the dorms and had to be in bed at 10:30.
So it was your fault, in other words.
It was my fault. And, you know, I really appreciate the person talking about shame earlier because it's debilitating. And I, you know, the hardest part for me now as an adult, I'm 45, is that every time I think of going to school because I dropped out, I get nightmares about being on campus and being, out of control of my life and looking for help. And I know that's, you know, something I can work through again. I'm just getting tired of the therapy.
I bet. Mary, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. And you got the last word on this. And I'd like to thank our guest, though, Cheryl Shakeshaft, professor and chairperson of the Department of Educational Leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Robert Shoup, whose book is Sexual Exploitation in Schools, How to Spot It and Stop It. And thank you, Robert Shoup, for your time.
Thank you for focusing on this.
I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.